I, by nature, am a risk taker. Are there other risk takers here? Raise your hand if you're a risk taker. Yeah, not bad. Yeah. Now, for those of you that okay, how about this? Who here used to be a risk taker and have settled down, gotten more safe in how you live? Any of those? Okay. It's interesting because I have found that the older I get and the longer I'm in it, the more safe I'm trying to become. No? You're getting more bold? Okay, so that's a fantastic thing. For me, I was a big risk taker all through my younger years. I did things that were kind of crazy, especially when it comes to areas of ministry, church planting, things like that. But it's as time goes on, I've been finding that it's a little bit difficult. So maybe, Jody, were you a risk taker in the past? No. So you're the same thing, that as you've gotten older, have you gotten to the point you're like, man, who cares? You know what? What are they going to do to me? What can anyone say about this? See, she doesn't care what any of you think. She does not care. Yeah. I love this passage. As we cover the passage, especially of Joseph of Arimathea, we learn a little bit about what it means to be a risk taker, especially for someone like Joseph. If you don't know anything about Joseph, he was, according to outside biblical sources, he was one of the wealthiest men in the region. They believe that he and especially Nicodemus were probably two of the most wealthy. But Joseph of Arimathea, a very, very wealthy man. Joseph of Arimathea also had some clout. He was a member of the Sanhedrin. Now, who is the Sanhedrin? The Sanhedrin would be the religious body that makes decisions. The Sanhedrin was the religious body that ultimately said, kill Jesus. Joseph of Arimathea was part of that council. Now, we know from other sources that Joseph of Arimathea was not present when the vote was taken. I think it was strategically done by the Sanhedrin because I think some people knew that Joseph was a disciple of Jesus. But a lot of people didn't. In fact, another gospel writer talks about Joseph of Arimathea and saying he was a secret follower of Jesus. That's what makes this instance so incredible to witness. If Joseph of Arimathea did not do what he did, I don't believe we would be as confident in the resurrection as we could be. Because in those days, if you died, the person that was going to be responsible for taking your body would be some family member. At this point, again, the only one that's really around that we can tell is Mary. Jesus had other brothers, one of them most notably a guy by the name of James. But we think at this point that James is not a believer. Also, as Jesus was crucified with blasphemy charges, he would be rejected. So there's a problem. What do you do with the body of Jesus? Mary and Joseph were poor. We know that when Jesus was dedicated, when he was circumcised, Mary and Joseph gave the offering that was reserved for the poorest of the poor. Two pigeons. That's it. There's supposed to be more, but they couldn't afford it. So the problem becomes, what do you do with the body? What should have happened, and what was most likely going to happen, was Jesus was going to be tossed into a pit, a place to dispose of the bodies that no one really wants. You could start to think how challenging this would be to prove a resurrection. If he was just simply dumped with a bunch of other bodies, how do you know that that body was raised from the dead? There's really a problem here. But who is going to pony up the money to pay for a tomb? Those things are expensive. And these tombs would become lifelong tombs. We see a little bit of this in the city of New Orleans. New Orleans has above-ground tombs that are generationally belong to families. And the way it typically would be is you would have two racks, two shelves. So if someone dies, you would take the body and you would put it in that above ground thing, and then you would seal it up, making sure no diseases or weird things would happen. And as that above ground thing would be down there in New Orleans, especially in the heat, it would just eventually, it would be a slow form of cremation. And then when that's done, there would be a pit in the back that you would then open up the tomb, and you would take a broom and you'd sweep the ashes, and it would just go, and you would commingle with your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, and then now it's open. And that way also, if another person died, then you could have one there, and then you could go ahead and put another one in, and hopefully no more than two. Now that's for, again, normal everyday folk, but there are some folk who had a ton of money. And especially in those days, in the time of Jesus, is if you had your own tomb that was a rock tomb, it would be hewn out of the side of a hill. And let me tell you, that would be expensive to do. I mean, they don't just pull out the excavation equipment and take it all out. This would all have to be dug out by hand. And then to do that in safety ways, and then you'd have to get a rock that's big enough that you can put in front of the tomb so that no one can just sit there and take your valuables once you're buried. So do you see how interesting that all of these details help us prove the resurrection? If it wasn't for Joseph of Arimathea, we'd be lost. But Joseph is now at a crossroads. He's a follower of Jesus. I think some people on the Sanhedrin know he's a follower of Jesus. But he hasn't come out and told everyone else. He's also so wealthy that the Romans know him, because Joseph can get an audience with the Roman governor named Pilate. But this is going to become difficult again. I have this money, I have this power, I have this clout with the Romans, and I have this religious leadership with the Jewish people. But if I take a stance with Jesus, I lose both. That's a risk. It's very challenging to think about how much of a risk that is. This would be for someone who's heading off to college, and they're going to a college that maybe doesn't really preach Jesus. And they're going to step forward and say, no, I'm a follower of God. This is when some people are moving up in their companies and their businesses. It hasn't quite been revealed that you follow God and you live your life accordingly. What kind of ridicule are you going to take from that? Maybe you're in the theater department. The theater department, wherever you're at, just doesn't have a lot of Christian people in it. But if you come out and tell people that you're a Christian, you might not get the lead. You might lose the part. You might be ostracized from your own community. This is where Joseph of Arimathea finds himself. He takes a risk that is pretty incredible, a risk that solidifies the fact of the resurrection. Without Joseph, we would be left to wondering, did it really happen? Maybe someone just grabbed the body. Maybe there were five other bodies placed on top of Jesus' body. You'd have no clue to know which one. You'd have all these animals eating at these bodies. Can you tell which one is whose? Joseph of Arimathea seals this deal. All right. Verse 57. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and that's what's really crazy. Not anyone can just get access to the Roman governor. Joseph of Arimathea is not only Sanhedrin, he's on the side of the Jewish people, but he's also wealthy enough and powerful enough that he can get this audience with the governor. And Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Of course, Pilate is also a little bit freaked out. If you remember from other texts, Pilate was shocked that Jesus was already dead. Because sometimes when you have crucifixion, those things can last for a little while. It could go on for days as you just struggle for breath. But of course, there was the quick and easy way to make sure that someone dies quickly on a cross. Just whack their legs. If you shatter their femur bone, then they can't push up in order to exhale. Their lungs are in a constant state of inhalation, so they can breathe in, but they just can't breathe out. You break the legs, you'll be gone within a couple of minutes. Jesus was already dead.
Pilate, what do you do? Crazy thing is, Pilate gives the body to Joseph. What if Pilate hadn't have done that? Again, we'd be left to wonder what actually happened. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out from the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. I think it's good to have Jesus in our grave. I know that graves are not something that I like to hang out in. I kind of get the eebie-jeebies every time I'm around tombstones or grave sites or cemeteries. I mean, do you feel the same way? I've heard of people, you know, kids at night, they'll go and hang out at the cemetery because no one else is there, but that's when you tell all the stories and you get a little freaked out by things. I just personally don't like it. I get a little claustrophobic, especially with this, but I think it's good to have Jesus in your tomb, because I think with Jesus in your tomb, you're not. If you have Christ in place of your death, you won't have to occupy it. Now, the problem is tombs come in all shapes and sizes, these literal tombs that we have, but there's also other tombs that people find themselves in all the time. People feel trapped. They feel dead. They feel hopeless. They feel like there's nothing left out there for them to do. Maybe it was a tomb of your own making. That happens. People do things, say things they shouldn't. They know they shouldn't. And now it doesn't really matter. It's nothing they can do about it. There's no real help. People sit inside the tombs as they run their hands over those rough-hewn things, as the light is dim, as the dust is thick. They cry out, I need some help. They don't know what to do. Maybe you're in a tomb made by someone else. Maybe someone else did something to you that caused you to now struggle and suffer. Maybe it was someone who came up to you and issued the divorce papers and said, I don't want anything to do with you. And now you're stuck in a tomb. What do I do from here? How am I going to handle this? I look at my future and there's nothing there. I'm going to be trapped for the rest of my life in this. Or maybe you had someone die and you're like, I don't know what to do. How do I go on? How do I face the future? I didn't ask for this. I didn't want to be here, but here I am. Maybe you did something when you were a child, something that you horribly regret. You have some, don't you? I know I do. I've got regrets from the past, things that I think about and I go, the shame that you think about. Hard. When I was a kid in high school, one of the things we liked to do in that high school was lunchtime. And there was a disabled kid that we loved to pick on. That's regret. You build up the shame and you don't know how do I get out from under it. Or maybe you did something to a boyfriend or girlfriend. Or maybe you did something with a boyfriend or girlfriend that you are ashamed of. Or maybe as a result of another choice, you add another sin on top of another sin on top of another sin. And these tombs are suffocating. But with Jesus, you're free. It's hard to imagine, it's hard to think, it's hard to appropriate to ourselves, but you're free. The guilt and the shame have been paid for. Why do you still have them? I struggle with this as I think of, you know, again, past things that I've done, and why do, when I think about it, I feel that extreme weight. I think part of it is that it's a reminder of my sinfulness, of my problems in life. I usually think these things, especially after I've had a really good week of being very righteous, being very holy. Man, this has been a good week. Man, I've done everything right. Oh, I'm so good. Oh, I could have gotten mad over there, but I didn't. I held my tongue. Oh, I could have honked at that person on the freeway because they were an idiot, but I didn't. Look how good I'm doing. And then all of a sudden you get reminded of other things. Maybe it also serves as a deterrent. I think so too. I think there's times that we feel guilt and shame. It maybe comes around with godly feelings because it helps us to go, I don't want to go down that path anymore. I did this. This is how I felt. I don't want to feel this way anymore. And I think those are wonderful feelings. I'll never forget the time we were at Heather's grandparents' house. Heather's grandparents, if you don't know, they grew up across the street from each other, which made it very handy when you wanted to go visit the family, because you were just like, okay, let's go see grandma and grandpa on this side of the street, and then you literally would walk across the other side of the street, and, you know, there they are. So we're there at grandma and grandpa Winnikin's house, and we'd brought our dog at the time, our dog Rouse, our rodent of unusual size. Yes, if you know. Thank you. Oh, those who are laughing is like, I think I got the movie reference. You are correct. If you don't got the movie reference, you need to Google it and watch it immediately. It should be a requirement for membership of this church. So we had our dog Rouse, and we're walking across the street, and we had forgotten that at the other side of the street, at Grandma and Grandpa Johnson's house, they owned 5 German Shepherds. It was very interesting because Grandma and Grandpa Johnson were like little tiny people. Like, you know, they were small, and their dogs were huge. Like, if a dog, one of them would have jumped up on Grandma Johnson, I think Grandma Johnson would have, like, gone over really fast. But let me tell you, they listened to Grandma Johnson. Like, they were obedient dogs because Grandma Johnson ruled that roost. And I remember as we're bringing Rouse across, and I don't know, what were we thinking? I was going back through this memory trying to figure out, like, why would we bring our dog? And this Rouse is a beagle. So, you know, he's, you know, Snoopy size, right? And we're just going to table grab, and we're walking him across the street, and we get over there, and sure enough, these 5 German Shepherds are like, ooh, snack time. Yum, 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 yum. And they come out, and they greet us in the thing, and they all 5 started circling, and I'm like, uh-oh. And I'm like, I reach down, and I start to kind of cover the dog, like, and then the dogs are coming in, and sure enough, one of them got to Rouse's ear before I could, you know, get it all covered up, and, you know, yelping, screaming, there's blood squirting. I'm like, oh, this is great. So I grab the dog, pick him up, and run him across the street. So Grandma, Grandpa Johnson, they're really sad. I'm really sorry that our dogs did that to you. That wasn't right. And, you know, please bring your dog back over. We're going to take all of the German Shepherds. We'll put them out in the backyard so that your dog will be safe. We're like, okay, this sounds good. So we put Rouse back on the leash, and we start going across the street. And it was funny because as we're going across the street, all of a sudden, come on, Rouse. And he's looking, she is looking. And I'm like, come on, Rouse, come on. And all of a sudden, I could feel it pull, and the dog's just turning around. And the dog's small. I'm pretty strong. I can yank that dog if I wanted to, but that dog yanked me. There was no way she was going to cross that street again. She said, I know the pain that's waiting for me across the street. I ain't going to feel that pain. Sometimes it's nice to feel that. We do that with our sin. Sometimes we do something so heinous, and we go, that was painful. Maybe it hurt us. Maybe it hurt family members. Maybe it hurt loved ones. And you're like, I don't want that anymore. Sometimes that's a great deterrent. The other reason why I think we sometimes suffer with guilt and shame is because that's exactly where the devil wants us to be. If the devil can take our lives and essentially make us ineffective, then I believe he's won. Some people have asked me, how do I know if I'm receiving godly instruction and I'm feeling godly shame and godly guilt, or when I experience evil shame and evil guilt? What's the difference? How do I tell the difference? Well, there's really one simple litmus test. It's the easiest test. I've handed this out to I don't know how many people, but it still bears repeating. If the shame and the guilt you're feeling drive you back to God, and you see Jesus on the cross, and you see that the tomb is empty and that Jesus is alive, and you don't have to bear that overwhelming guilt anymore, that's God. If the guilt and the shame that you're feeling drives you away from church, I can't go back, I am a sinner, I am worse than everyone sitting there, everyone else looks happy, their lives are together, no one's struggling the way I'm struggling, God's probably not happy that I'm in his house. That is not from God. And you've got to accept that. That is Satan trying to keep you away from truth. That is Satan trying to keep you away from the freedom that all of us get to experience. Because with Jesus in our tomb, we are free. If we invite Jesus into our tomb, we are free. And it's scary because sometimes as we sit in there, again, we feel the shame and the weight of guilt and this stuff, and it's suffocating us and we can't breathe. And here comes Jesus saying, you have been set free. You no longer have to stay here. You're not trapped anymore by your actions. You may now go. But some of us, we still hang on to it. The door is open. It's ready for us to walk out of. And there we are saying, no, I need to pay for this a little bit more. I need to make sure this becomes my identity a little bit more. And the answer is no. Your past sin does not identify you. The freedom Christ gives you identifies you. No, you don't need to pay for it any longer. It's already been paid for. Now, the way we pay for things is often very subtle. And this is where I think, Christian, I think in a basic sense, we could say, did Jesus pay for all my sins? And we go, yeah. But I think sometimes there's still sins we go, yeah, but I really should, I should do something about that. If you slip into that, then there was no reason for Jesus to die. You're essentially saying what he went through was pointless. You know, this was really, really bad. And you know what? I'm going to prove it to God. I'm going to prove to God how much I love him. I'm going to go to church more often. You're going to pay for it, huh? You know what? God has been so good to me. And you know what? I have done so badly. And you know what? I've got to pray more. I've just got to pray more. Really? You know, I've got to do, if you find yourself saying things like, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, chances are you're slipping into, I'm going to pay for it. I was out to lunch the other day, and I met this lady, and she was a born-again believer, and she was talking to me, and she didn't know that I was a pastor until at one point she was talking about how the only way that you can pray is to come to God and say, God, I'm a sinner, and I have no right to stand before you. And if you don't pray those words prior to your prayer, then your prayer is null and void. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. You've got to do that or else your prayer isn't answered. And I said, really? I said, what do you do with then all the prayers in the Bible? Prayers of David. Peter's prayer is the best, right? He's sinking under the water and he throws out a prayer, one prayer. Save me. Because I think he probably would have started choking if he was like, dear Lord, I am a miserable sinner, and I can't. If you start adding to what God has already done for you, then it's not necessary. Then Jesus' death was in vain. So if you have Jesus in your tomb, you're free to go. Stop trying to pay for it. It's already done. It's already accomplished. We sang it in the song. It is finished, as long as you do a couple extra things. No. It is finished. But shouldn't I? No. Do we get the privilege of? Do we, in our attitude of thankfulness, do we get the privilege of then serving God in whatever capacity. But it's not some law. God's not up there going, well, you only spent 32 minutes with me in prayer, and as we know, 35 minutes a day is minimum, so you have now been kicked out of the kingdom of God. But if you just upped your prayers by 3 minutes, and if you would just simply add that opening thing of, I am a poor, miserable sinner, you would have actually made it up to that thing. Stop adding to what God has already done. It is finished. Invite Jesus into your tomb so that you're made alive, and you no longer have to stay there. I often wonder, things that pastors think of that we can't get answers to but are fun to think of anyway. When was Jesus gone? We know that he dies. We know that Joseph grabs the body. The body is embalmed. Tons of spices. And these spices are very gummy, and you would anoint the body, and then you would wrap the body from head to toe, and then you would place the body in the tomb. When was the body gone? Because we know on Easter, the body's not there, right? We're thankful it's Joseph Arimathea's tomb. We're thankful because we know where it would be at. The women were just sitting across from where they laid him. They know that he's in there. When did that body disappear? I know that sometimes I've seen it in movies. It seems to be that the body remained there until right before the rock rolled away. I don't know. I don't know if it was. I don't think that's the truth. I can't prove it. This is stupid things that pastors think of. You know when I think the body was gone? I think the body was gone the moment the rock was rolled in front of it. So we know from another scripture passage that Jesus at that point went to preach to the spirits in prison. We also know that when the angels came and the earthquake happened and the rock was rolled out of the way, it wasn't to let Jesus out. He's not in there knocking. Guys, this is a heavy rock. Oh, wait, I can levitate these things. That's right, I'm God. No, it's not to get Jesus out. The rolling of the rock away was to let us in to the empty tomb. So I think it's gone. That's what makes this next section so hilarious. And we're grateful for it. Again, all of these things that happen, you start reading them and you're like, why were these included in Scripture? These were included for a very specific reason, to prove to you that it's truth. The next day, oh, by the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, this next section is unique to Matthew. Again, thank you, Matthew, for including this stuff, because it's really good. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. I don't know why, but it's just hilarious. The disciples, were any of the disciples waiting for Jesus to rise from the dead on the third day? No, they're running, right? And we talked about it last year, right? Like, Jesus said, I'm going to die, and then 3 days later come back to life. And you can track it, like, I don't know how many times he said it. None of the disciples believe it. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law do? This is fantastic. Because they're going to do something to make sure that there is no deception that takes place. So they're like, you know, this guy, he's a deceiver. And you know what? There might be a stealing of the body issue. Because that's what they say. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. The last deception will be worse than the first. So like, let's just get a guard. Let's make sure it's sealed up so that no one can steal the body. Because that's sometimes what people think. Maybe the disciples came and stole the body. Did the disciples come and steal the body? They couldn't. Why? Because they were scared and they were already running. They didn't even think he was going to come back to life. They were hiding in upper rooms for fear of the Jews. This was all the stuff that was taking place. And also the disciples, what was their occupation? A couple of them are fishermen. We got a tax collector. Maybe we got Simon the Zealot. Maybe he I would want on my team because he's going to go a little crazy. You know, that's that crazy friend that you have. Yeah, that's Simon the Zealot. He might be able to do, but everyone else, are any of these guys trained in hand-to-hand combat? No, Peter, how good is he with a sword? Oh, sorry about the ear there, brother. Yeah, none of these guys can do it. It's sealed. And also, a guard is placed. Now, the question becomes, which guard gets placed at the tomb? because unfortunately with this next phrase, Pilate, NIV translators in my 1984 version, I think, have nailed it on the head. They say, take a guard, Pilate answered. Go make the tomb as secure as you know how. So take a guard. In other words, it says, you have a guard, go make it secure, right? Does anyone have that as a translation? So if you have that as a translation, the way it's constructed is either Pilate is saying, look, you guys got your own guard, which they do. Remember when Jesus was arrested, who were the people that came to arrest him? It was the Jewish guards. It was the chief priest's personal bodyguard was there to take him out. So was Pilate saying, well, you got your own guard. You take your people, go make it secure. I don't really care about this. I'm just done with it. No, really, the way it's phrased is, oh, you now have a guard. It's a Roman guard. The reason why we know this is because after, and we'll get to this next week, when the guards encounter an empty tomb, who do they run to? They don't run to the chief priests. They run to Pilate. Why are they reporting back to Pilate? Because this is Pilate's guards. These are Roman guards. Roman guards! Who here would like that job? Hey, Brutus, we're going to go guard a tomb. Wait, we're going to guard? Yeah, we're going to guard a dead person. Wait, what? What is this dead person going to do? I don't know, but we're just supposed to guard it. This is a cushy little job, yeah? Yeah, yeah. You can imagine this, like, oh, well, you know, we can make this thing completely secure. I mean, again, you're gonna put a guard in front of it. The disciples can't steal the body. And again, this goes against the other thought that people go, well, maybe the people went to the wrong tomb. Oh, you went to the wrong tomb? You mean, what about the big gigantic tomb that has the guards in front of it? Yeah, maybe that's the one we should have gone to? Yeah, no, the guards were gone. They were, that's next week's sermon. That's next week's sermon. So good. These guards, I love them. No, I'm not going to say it. And so they made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. A seal on the stone. What was a seal on the stone? Well, you would take a cord or a rope of some type of thing. You'd put wax, and you'd put the signet ring would hit the wax, and that would then show who put this wax seal here. And it's a lot like police lines. You know, don't enter. You know, don't take this Tylenol if the seal's been broken. Right? That's what happened. You break the seal, the punishment is. Yeah. And do you guys remember that? Only two people answered. I'm a little disappointed. Was that a little fast? Was it a little fast? The punishment for something like that would be?
Death.
Yeah, very good. Death, Jesus, the answers. Death and Jesus. This is what's so fascinating about this. It's now secure. No one's going to get in. Jesus ain't getting out. Yeah. You know, oh, Jesus just fainted. Really? He fainted. He's got wounds on his hands. Like, I could barely walk after a hamstring injury, and Jesus, like, oh, I'll just push this rock away. No. The disciples didn't steal the body. The Romans didn't move the body. Jesus' tomb is empty. And that's what you need. You need Jesus in your tomb so that you can be free. Now, I know some of you want to keep crawling back in there. I still need to do something about this. No, you don't. Jesus is already there, and the tomb is already empty. And by Pilate and Joseph of Arimathea doing this, it once again proves that sometimes it's important to take risks. Sometimes it's important to let people know where it is you stand. Maybe not everyone in your family knows that you're a believer. That can happen. I understand that. I that's amazing when that happens. Maybe not every one of your friends know. You kind of keep it hush hush, especially with the friends, because you don't want them to think that you're a Jesus freak, because that'd be just creepy. You don't want to become some religious nut. Maybe some of your coworkers, or some of your classmates, like, well, they don't really know. Sometimes you just need to take a risk. Joseph of Arimathea took a risk to let everybody know that with Jesus in my tomb, I am free. I am free to follow.
Don't crawl back in. Don't stay where you're at. Don't be happy with the cobwebs and the dust and the dankness and the dim light. Maybe it's time we exit the grave and enter the glorious light that Jesus gives to us. Let's pray. Father, thank you that you occupy tombs. And thank you that it's a promise that with you in our tomb, we're alive. But if we don't have you, or if we try to pay for things on our own, or if we try to pay back this debt, and really Jesus didn't pay for it, some of us are still struggling, still hurting. And you've given us this invitation to come and receive this wonderful gift. And maybe right now, Lord, you're breaking down walls, you're breaking down barriers, you're softening our hearts. Maybe just us even being here is saying something to God. Maybe our future or our family members in the future, we're thinking about how we're going to be talking about them, about what we believe, and that we can finally get rid of all the guilt and the shame that we've been storing up and been struggling with, and we can finally say, Lord, you've paid for it. And when we feel it and we feel the weight of that shame and it drives us back to the cross, we see Jesus, we behold that man that's upon that cross, but then we look and we see that the tomb is empty, and we're grateful. So Lord, move in our hearts now so that we might have you in our tomb, so that we can be alive because of Jesus, who is alive, who is ruling and reigning with you and the Holy Spirit as one God, now and forever. Amen.